The Nobel Prize goes to in vitro fertilization, a hate speech trial in the Netherlands. Britain cuts the welfare state, how we remember our misdeeds, digital readers bend the curve, and why handwriting is still important. It's Wednesday, October 6, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On Monday, the Nobel Prize Committee in Stockholm, Sweden, announced that the 2010 Nobel Prize for Medicine would go to Dr. Robert Edwards, known around the world as the founder of the test tube baby technology. That first test tube baby, Louise Brown, was born in 1978, and since then, over 4 million babies have been born by utilizing the technology. The idea was revolutionary at the time, going back to the 1970s. Dr. Edwards and his colleagues were determined to help infertile couples, using a technology that, frankly, had been considered a matter of science fiction until the birth of Louise Brown in 1978. The technology was revolutionary. Human reproductive cells, the sperm and the egg, were combined in a laboratory within the context of a petri dish, thus the term in vitro fertilization, or in glass. The 4 million babies born by means of this technology are testimony to the fact that what Dr. Robert Edwards did back in 1978 was indeed to accomplish something that would change the face of modern reproductive technologies. Now, looking back over the last several years, indeed over the period from 1978 until the present, we can see not only the numerical impact, but a closer look reveals that this was a great moral transformation as well. The idea that a human infant could be conceived outside of the normal process of biological reproduction and instead conceived within a laboratory led to a breakdown, a severing of human reproduction from the context of natural sexual relations between a husband and a wife. The reality is that in vitro fertilization not only allowed infertile married couples to have babies, but increasingly separated the idea of reproduction from the context of marriage at all. In the past couple of decades, single women have utilized the technology to have babies without a husband or even a male partner. Lesbian couples have used the technology to achieve babies, and gay male couples have used the technology along with a surrogate mother in order, as they style it, to have children. The separation of the sex act from the procreation of children is no minor moral transformation. And what we have seen with the development of the test tube baby is that it has led to a myriad of other moral complications as well. We cannot talk about the process of human in vitro fertilization without acknowledging the creation of hundreds of thousands of excess human embryos. That's exactly how they are styled. They are excess. These are embryonic human beings who will never see life, who have been frozen for a number of years, perhaps even decades, and in the case of some countries, they've merely been allowed to thaw and thus be destroyed. No doubt, in vitro fertilization as a technology has brought great joy to many married couples, to parents who have been longing for children and by means of this technology have been able to achieve them. But we need to recognize the social cost that the society itself is not calculating as this award is presented to Dr. Edwards by the Nobel Committee. As evidence of the less thoughtful approach to celebrating this achievement, Robin Marantz Hennig, writing in the New York Times, suggests that the initial outcry against in vitro fertilization, the concerns as to where the technology might lead back in 1978, were ill-founded. She wrote this, "This is a lesson to keep in mind as we debate whether to pursue other promising yet controversial medical advances from genetic engineering to human cloning." End quote. Now, oddly enough, what Ms. Hennig has done here is to point to exactly the kind of scary scenario that the acceptance of in vitro fertilization leads us to responsibly consider. Those who have suggested that in vitro fertilization would not lead to the very things Ms. Hennig talks about fail to consider that once the door to such a technology is opened, it is very difficult to close it. The New York Times and other major media are celebrating this award. The Roman Catholic Church has registered its concern given its opposition to in vitro fertilization. Almost anyone who suggests that there is any moral question about IVF technology is marginalized and written off by some as something of a crank. After all, the tendency of anyone is to point to these babies and to the joy the babies have brought their parents and suggest that this is a sufficient justification for the use of virtually any technology. But consider the logic of that argument. It doesn't go very far, and can lead directly to abject disaster. Several years ago, I was asked to contribute a book chapter in a medical symposium on the ethics of in vitro fertilization. After long and careful consideration, I came to the point that I could not recommend IVF, and in this article, I suggested why. A copy of that article is available on my website at albertmohler.com. In announcing the award, the Nobel Committee said, "By a brilliant combination of basic and applied medical research, Dr. Edwards overcame one technical hurdle after another in his persistence to discover a method that would help to alleviate infertility. His contributions represent a milestone in the development of modern medicine." End quote. It's just natural that the committee awarding this kind of prize would champion the positive aspects of the achievement. Nowhere do we note that the Nobel Prize Committee acknowledged the dangers that were then and now inherent in this technology. Then again, thinking of the double-edged nature of many technologies, let us remember that the Nobel Prizes are funded by and named for a man whose primary invention was dynamite. Christians should pay close attention to a story coming out of the Netherlands. It's a hate speech trial that is capturing international attention. Geert Wilders, a Dutch politician, is on trial for comments that he has made about Islam. He has said such things as this: "I've had enough of Islam in the Netherlands. Let not one more Muslim immigrate." He said, "I've had enough of the Quran in the Netherlands. Forbid that fascist book." Mr. Wilders says he has a right to criticize any religion he chooses, says USA Today. He told the three judges overseeing his trial that he would continue to proclaim his views no matter what the sentence. Quote, "I am a suspect here because I have expressed my opinion as a representative of the people." End quote. This was said by Mr. Wilders at the start of his trial. "I am on trial here today, but with me, the freedom of expression of many, many Dutch people is also being judged." Now, according to the press, this three-judge panel will bring a verdict about Mr. Wilders, who could face, if he's found guilty, a prison sentence of up to a year, along with other sanctions. Now, as we look at this story, we recognize where hate speech leads. There are two big aspects of this story that should have the Christian attention. Number one, the very danger of hate speech legislation and the inevitability of hate speech trials once such legislation is put in place. Another aspect of this story that should capture our attention is the nature of Islam in terms of feeling wounded. Islam is an honor religion, and those who are the adherents of Islam feel that it is their responsibility to protect the honor of Islam, of the Prophet Muhammad, and of the Quran. And for that reason, there are calls for trials such as this and for the imposition of hate speech legislation. In the European courts and parliament, there are increasing pressures from the European Muslim community to legislate offenses against the honor of Islam, to make it criminal or sanction to make any criticism of Islam, of Muhammad, or of the Quran. Interestingly, one Muslim authority, Mohammed Rabai, chairman of the Moderate National Moroccan Council, said that he did not want Geert Wilders put in jail. Instead, he said that he hoped he would be forced to apologize. Well, remember that being forced to apologize means that the social power and the legal sanction of the state are being used to coerce speech. That's a warning we need to hear on both sides of the Atlantic. As World War II drew to a close, the logic of many European governments was to move in the direction of socialism. The precise form of socialism adopted by most European countries, including Great Britain, was the welfare state. The welfare state was predicated upon the assumption that the government should tax and use those heavy taxes in order to distribute and redistribute income so that the state itself would serve as the agent of preserving the welfare of its citizens. The welfare state was a central part of European culture from the 1940s and the end of World War II until at least the last decade. However, the financial pressures not only of the latest recession, but of the ongoing borrowing that was required for this kind of government spending has led to a reconsideration of the welfare state, interestingly enough, even in Scandinavia, where it is in its strongest form. But in Great Britain, the welfare state was a matter of national pride after the end of the war. And yet, all of a sudden, even under a conservative coalition government, the British Parliament has announced that it is moving towards the elimination of some child assistance benefits that were a central part of the welfare state in England. Now, this is capturing news all over the world because this child assistance fund that was given, regardless of parental income, to every parent that had a child in Great Britain was intended to help facilitate a higher birth rate, especially as the nation was rebuilding its population after the war. Well, Britain still has the need for an increased birth rate, at least in terms of Britons having babies, but it has run out of money. And as it has run out of money, it's having to ask some basic questions, reconsidering the character of the welfare state. Now, even as the British government has announced its intentions to move in this direction, an outcry from the British people may put something of a quick end to those plans. But the fundamental reality is that Britain is running out of money, and this alteration in the welfare state is not the end of the process, but almost certainly the beginning. An absolutely fascinating story that appeared in the New York Times by Benedict Carey asked the question as to how we remember our misdeeds. The title of the article is All Indiscretions Appear Youthful. Once you read the article, you understand the title. It turns out that a great deal of scientific research indicates that when persons are asked about a moral act that they have committed, that is a positive act, one that they believe will bring about admiration, they almost always point to an act in the fairly recent past, indeed, the very recent past in most cases. But when these same individuals are asked to recall an immoral act, something that they did wrong, they tend to go not only to the distant past, but to their most distant past. Now, this is really interesting from a Christian worldview. It turns out that one evidence of our fallenness is that we do not want to admit that we are wrong. We do not want to confess our misdeeds. And if we are put in a position where we are almost forced to do so, we are likely to reach back into our childhood or adolescence. The title of the article, Why All Indiscretions Appear Youthful, is, as Benedict Carey suggests in this article, something of a coping mechanism. And we ought to understand just about everything about coping mechanisms. When Adam and Eve fashioned aprons for themselves out of fig leaves, that was a coping mechanism, as was the fact that they tried to hide from God in the garden. The reality is that in a sinful state, human beings try to rationalize their sin. Even when we admit our sin, as Benedict Carey details here, documenting the scientific research, we tend to reach way back in the past to distance ourselves most clearly from our own wrongs. One doctor quoted in the study said, "The weirdest thing about reading about all these moral choices is that it makes you feel kind of good about yourself, just seeing how everyone makes mistakes and regrets not doing what was morally right. It makes you feel more attached to humanity." End quote. Well, that's the point, isn't it? The more we can share in the misdeeds of others and rationalize our own misdeeds, the better we feel about ourselves. And that's the nature of sinners. We want to feel better about ourselves. A report on reading indicates that those who own digital devices, Kindles, iPads, Nooks, and all the rest, are actually reading a good deal more than those who do not have such devices. As the paper reports, people who own digital reading devices read more newspapers, magazines, and books and spend more time reading than folks without those gadgets. The research was done by the Harrison Group. Tablet and e-reader owners between 18 and 64 years old reported spending 50% more time reading magazines. Users of tablets such as the iPad said they spent nearly 75% more time reading newspapers and 25% more time reading books. Another interesting fact about these devices is how quickly they are being purchased by serious readers. Those who feared that the emergence of these devices would mean the end of reading now have to reckon with the fact that a good deal of reading among the most serious and voracious readers has moved to these machines. The last item of our consideration comes from the Wall Street Journal. The headline of the story is How Handwriting Trains the Brain. Research indicates that a good deal of learning takes place by learning handwriting. Now, as this documents, as a child learns to write with the hand, to force the hand to form letters and the letters to form sentences and the sentences to form paragraphs, as the child's eye and hand move together in concert in order to shape these letters as a means of communication, the brain is actually being rewired, and a good deal of learning is being reinforced and put into place in usable form such that the child can access it and understand it and manipulate it to a greater degree later on. Now, we ought to keep this in mind, parents and educators especially, as we recognize that children are to a far lesser degree than at any time in recent history being taught to write with the hand. Handwriting is something of a disappearing art. When I was a child, we learned first block printing and then moved to cursive writing, And over a period of time, it was expected that our cursive writing and handwriting would improve to such an extent that, well, to put it bluntly, someone would be able to read our essays and grade our tests. In many schools, the pen and pencil have given way to the laptop and the screen. Now this research suggests that parents who have feared that this means something of a loss of learning on the part of their children, well, they now have documentation to know that it is so. The recovery of handwriting, it turns out, might not be just about handwriting. It might be about wiring the brain for increased learning, retention, and the usability of data. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a wealth of resources at my website at albertmohler.com. To follow me on Twitter, go to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.